Welcome back, everybody, and happy Friday afternoon. Hope you all are doing well. We got a great guest coming up in just a few moments, but I wanted to give some of our amazing listeners an opportunity to finish our thoughts from the last discussion over the past hour. There was a very interesting article that was published today in the Washington Post. Its title is this: The Secretive Donor Circle That Lifted J.D. Vance Is Now Rewriting MAGA's Future. It talks about a donor named Chris Buskirk. And in essence, we're going to share that article in our show notes for today. You can always find those at civicmedia.us/shows. Just look for my show. Go to today's show. You'll find all the supporting info. What Buskirk, Peter Thiel, J.D. Vance, and this group, this very elite group of MAGA operatives want to see is a new American aristocracy. They don't like to use the word oligarch, but they literally are embracing this idea of an American aristocracy where that aristocracy is presumably benevolent, I guess, and is the one that it's that group, this very, very small elite group of aristocrats that basically control government and decide how America is run. That's what they want to see. And so there is a through line between what I'm going to talk about with my next guest and what the entirety of our prior conversation was about. And that is by basically over the last 50 years, fundamentally changing our system of taxation that was supercharged by the Supreme Court saying money is speech and corporations are people. They're not, and money isn't speech. But by doing that, what we've seen is one of the greatest transfers, if not the greatest transfer of wealth over the last 50 years from the middle class to the ultra, ultra elites. And now, with Mr. Buskirk, Mr. Vance, Peter Thiel, and others, you see what is the political system, the fruition of that massive transfer of wealth. They say, oh, well, no, those working stiffs, they really shouldn't decide how our government is run. Pretty scary. And that is being systematized and legitimized by the Supreme Court failing to protect the franchise, our access to the voting booth. I'm going to introduce my guest in just a moment, but I want to get a couple of our callers in. Sherry from Horicon, welcome to the show. What you got for us this Maggie. Afternoon?
Maggie, my friend. Okay, so I was on Medicaid, and a lot was covered. I had like $230 for food share, and then I turned 65, so now I'm on Medicare. And now I Social Security is like $780 a month. And then my food share went down to like $80 a month after Trump. And I don't know how they expect people to live, you know.
Yeah.
And I'm struggling. So it's, you know. Groceries aren't going down, gas isn't going down, nothing's going down. Oh, golly gee whiz. So
except for your benefits. Except for your benefits. Things get more expensive.
My benefits went down. At the beginning, my Social Security was like a little over $1,000. He came into office and it's like 700 and something. You know, it...
Because Sherry had that to spare. Are you kidding me? Sorry, Sherry, we want to squeeze a couple more callers in before we get to our guest. Joe from Madison, if you can, be brief, but welcome back.
I just want to say in response to Sherry, call again. I think people need to understand how brutal and how tough it is where you are. And your willingness to share that information is absolutely crucial, and we really, really appreciate it, and I feel incredibly upset that you're going through this stuff. I don't know. Maybe, Maggie, you can speak to this. I was under the impression that Governor Evers did something where he basically supplied money into the EBT cards. Do you know if Sherry might be affected by something like that? Are you aware of this situation?
Yeah, Evers, from accounts that we've been trying to verify all day here at Civic Media, people's food share cards should be fully funded as of this morning. That is what Evers did overnight. It's interesting. Government can certainly move fast when it wants to. And again, kudos to Governor Evers for doing that. And I echo Joe's sentiments. Thank you. Thank you to Sherry for sharing her story. You want to do that? You've got a story to share? We matter at civicmedia.us. We matter at civicmedia.us. Mike from Muscadet, what you got for us this afternoon?
Oh, you got Muscadet right. I appreciate that. Finally, Maggie. You got that?
You're welcome,
now.
Sir. Go ahead. Go ahead.
Well, I just want to say, if in the future you could bring up a guest or just get on this topic, is how do politicians or Senate, Congress, how do they go into office, like Barack Obama take, for instance? How do they go in as just simple people, just common people that come out multimillionaires?
It's a great question, Mike. I'll do it this week. I'm going to find a block to do that. Maybe my senior producer, Jamie, can find me a block in my week, Mike, before the end of the show so I can tell you when I'm going to talk about this. Barack Obama made his millions after he exited the White House, largely from speaking engagements, writing books, etc. The problem, Mike, that you're speaking to, and this is a problem on both the Democratic side and the Republican side, is that Congress has refused to effectively ban themselves from owning stock in companies that they oversee in their committee assignments. So there's a huge insider trading problem, I would say. They do not require blind trusts for Congress people. There's a whole number of system reforms, Mike. And again, this has been a problem on both the Democratic and Republican side. Barack Obama making millions of dollars from giving speeches and writing books after he's president doesn't really bother me. Congress people that stay in Congress for 40 years and have access to sensitive inside information, and we do not have a regulatory system that prevents them from trading to their benefit on that inside information, that bothers me. I'll tell you what else bothers me. A president whose personal net worth has increased by $2 billion since he took office, who refused to put his assets into a blind trust and is now cutting deals in very obvious pay-to-play circumstances, that bothers me. Barack Obama did divest himself and did put all of his personal investments into a blind trust. He never touched any of it. And his net worth, if you track it over the course of his presidency, did not move substantially at all. Not worried about Barack, deeply worried about Trump. And if we want to talk about Barack Obama and Democrats who appear to have benefited from being in public office, then you've got to be honest about what Donald Trump is doing, which is completely an aberration and we have never seen anything like the explosion in wealth for the Trump organization and Donald Trump personally as we have in this second Trump administration. It is without historical precedent. And those laws need to be strengthened as well. Every elected official, in my opinion, Republican, Democrat, independent, purple, polka-dotted people eater, they should all be accountable, and we should have very strong laws that prevent profiteering off holding public office, as well as term limits. Thank you for the question, Mike. We are going to have time, not today, Jamie, but later this week, hopefully. And Mike, I will make sure that I tell you when I'm going to talk about this because I want to talk about those system reforms in great detail. With that, folks, let's talk about the franchise. Let's talk about what has been going on with the Supreme Court and ensuring that each and every one of us that have the right to vote actually get to exercise that vote and that that vote matters. That is incredibly important. With that, I want to introduce Professor Stephen Wright. He is a clinical professor at UW Law School, my alma mater, if you've been listening to this show for a while. He has graduated from Duke, Johns Hopkins, and of course, the University of Wisconsin-Madison, and he eventually got his JD at WashU in St. Louis. He has more degrees than I have fingers on a hand, basically. Welcome to the program, Professor Wright. It's a real pleasure to have you.
Thank you for having me.
Very briefly, what is the Voting Rights Act? How did it come about? And what wrong did it seek to redress?
Sure. The Voting Rights Act for a very long time was known as the greatest piece of American legislation in all of American history. The idea was it attempted to eradicate all forms of racial discrimination in voting, primarily in the South, but there was also prevalent cases of discrimination against Native Americans and Latinos throughout the country. But it was the centerpiece of President Johnson's effort to bring about a more equal society. And it did so by eliminating things like the discriminatory placement of polling places, of unfair registration practices, of old school tests that made like grandfather clauses and reading tests. And so it really was the greatest opportunity for Congress and the federal government to fulfill the promise of citizenship and the opportunity to participate in our democracy fully for people of color.
It's incredibly important, and you know quite a bit about it. You, of course, were also a litigator with the voting section of the U.S. Department of Justice, which has basically been nearly entirely gutted under this administration, which speaks to what the priorities are for this administration when it comes to voting. Tell us a little bit about what the Supreme Court did a few years ago about what they call the pre-certification requirement that came under the Voting Rights Act. The Supreme Court basically invalidated a key portion of the Voting Rights Act. What was it? What is pre-certification and why does it matter?
Yeah, so part of the challenge of desegregating the United States and in particular the South is an individual would bring a lawsuit and then they would win the lawsuit, but the South or the Southern jurisdiction would find a sort of slippery way around it. And so what the government did in Section 5 of the Voting Rights Act in 1965 did was created a mechanism where if any Southern state or states that had a extreme history of discrimination decided to make any type of voting change, they had to get pre-clearance or pre-certification from the federal government. And about 10 years ago, despite the court acknowledging that this was one of the most transformative aspects of the Voting Rights Act, they decided that it was no longer appropriate and eliminated the pre-clearance requirement. Since then, several studies have shown almost conclusively that there's been a lot of fallback, that polling places in African-American neighborhoods have decreased, the bus rides that take that people without cars need to take to get to the polls have decreased, voting rolls and voting opportunities in many communities have essentially gone away.
Yeah, here in Milwaukee and in Wisconsin, we've had souls to the polls for a long time. That was the beginning of the Supreme Court's attack on the Voting Rights Act. The logic of the Voting Rights Act is now about to be turned on its head, on its ear, whatever metaphor you want to use. We're going to talk specifically with Professor Wright on the other side about the threat that Louisiana v. Calais poses and why it matters to every voter, regardless of political preference, and regardless if you happen to be a black or brown folk or white folk or any kind of folk. Access to the franchise matters to hold the wealthy accountable and to make sure government works for the vast majority of us. Stay tuned. This is the Civic Media Radio Network.